as we continue our focus on some of the feedback Congress is getting as it gets ready to put together another round of DoD acquisition reforms. Our next guest was asked to testify before the House Armed Services Committee last month, where he made the point that the Pentagon's current structure for analysis is one of the factors that leads to acquisition programs that are too slow and too costly. While there is plenty of brain power dedicated to making the best acquisition decisions, those analysts all have different incentives and too often are not pointed toward the same objective. Chris Lamb is Deputy Director of the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, and he joins us now. Dr. Lamb, thanks very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And after your testimony, we wanted to pick your brain a little bit more on this issue, because I frankly don't think I've ever heard anyone frame DoD's acquisition challenges in exactly this way. One of the points you seem to be making is this analytical structure that's supposed to provide good decision-making tools to the Secretary actually just winds up giving him kind of a mush of watered-down recommendations that aren't all that helpful. And I don't think he used the word mush, but talk to me about some of the organizational issues you've identified in acquisition.
Yeah, I might have avoided the word mush. But what I was basically saying was that if you look inside of an acquisition program, it goes through a number of milestone steps. But the heart of it is a set of key performance parameters on how the system is supposed to function. Often these are kind of stretch goals, and they're very challenging. And what I was trying to say was that the system right now does not give a program manager in charge of one of these programs much incentive for trading off between those performance parameters. So let's say you have a plane that is technologically advanced and flying as fast as you want it to, but its radar range is limited. Would you accept that as a good outcome, speed in exchange for radar coverage, or any number of other potential trade-offs between various performance parameters inside the program? And my point was, to wrap up this thought, was that for a program manager to make that kind of decision intelligently, he has to have a context for that decision. How does that plane operate among a larger group of airplanes in an operational concept in the kinds of warfighting scenarios that we expect to put those airplanes into? And right now, the Pentagon doesn't make decisions on that basis. Instead, we kick off a program, we do all that analysis up front, we say, okay, this looks good, and then we put the program manager in charge of managing that program until it's successful across all these key performance parameters. The natural result is that the programs stretch out and they get more and more expensive because it's very difficult to make those kinds of trade-off decisions.
Well, again, the Pentagon has plenty of analytical capacity that it could push toward informing those trade-offs after the kickoff of a program. So what are the things that impair those resources from going toward that?
Well, in part it's because of the way we budget. The money goes to the services, and the services have a need for the largest amount of analytic talent, and they use it at a relatively low level, the engineering level or one-on-one performance of new platforms that they're considering, and they have a whole lot of data and modeling and understanding of their weapon systems. The problem is that when you take it up a notch into a joint operating environment, we don't have as much analytic support. The joint staff has limited ability to analyze the services platforms and their performance in a joint environment. It has a very small group in J-8 that does that. We also have experts in CAPE who look across these programs and look at things from a joint operating concept point of view, but they're very small. So the Secretary really doesn't have a lot of joint analytic talent at his disposal. In fact, all the data is basically owned by the services. Most of the models are owned by the services, and they basically control the analytic process in the Pentagon. So unless we muscle that up, it's going to be hard to improve our decision support for the Secretary.
Well, and it sounds like not just the analytic capacity, but the actual data that could inform those trade-offs actually exists. So is it being hidden from higher-level decision-makers, or is it not being generated in the first place?
Well, no, I wouldn't say hidden, but as you can imagine, control of data is a very, very sensitive matter. I mean, first of all, there are classification issues. So you can look at the performance of a platform like the F-22, and you have a secret set of data, you have a top secret set of data, and you have code word data, and deciding in what in what environment amongst what groups you want to reveal the performance data is in itself a very challenging decision. So I wouldn't say it's being hidden, but it's naturally the case that organizations don't want their data appropriated by others and misused. So if you don't have a structured system for saying under what circumstances you would share data and how the analysis would be conducted and that the owners of that data would be involved and able to point out flaws in how it's used or caveats about how it's being used, then they're not necessarily going to trust other parties to use that data. So they tend to guard it closely.
The case study that you used in your testimony was the Mine Resistant Ambush Protected Vehicle Program, MRAPs as they're more commonly called, which I think you could say really was a joint program, but only really got off the ground because the Secretary of Defense personally made it his mission in life. Is that an illustration of this disconnect between the analytic capacity and the services and what's available to the joint community?
Well, I think it is in a couple of respects. First of all, the MRAP was a joint program, but what people don't realize is that you cannot start a joint acquisition program without a validated requirement. So the various systems in the Pentagon are linked to one another. The acquisition system is at the behest of the requirement system. What that means is if the generals and admirals don't come together and say, yes, we really need that MRAP, then the acquisition system can't kick off the program to provide it to our soldiers in the field. So the interesting thing about the MRAP program was that the system was unanimous in rejecting the vehicle because they looked at it too narrowly, at its strategic value too narrowly. And it took the Secretary of Defense reading a USA Today article to say, hey, why aren't we providing this vehicle to our troops? And when he looked into the matter, he found out that commanders in the field had asked for it repeatedly. But after 2 years of delay, the system still had not validated the requirements so that the acquisition system could go about procuring it and delivering it.
So we're pushing toward 30 years since the passage of the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which was supposed to move us all toward joint nirvana. There obviously are still some problems. What would it take to move some of this analytical capability and the organizational changes that you think need to happen up to that higher level where you do get the trade-offs that you need to make?
Well, it's interesting you bring up Goldwater-Nichols because I think it offers us an example of great success in the field where you have the same sort of trade-offs between the services, how they go about prosecuting the battle in the joint battle space. And only when you put one person in charge of that, the combatant commander, who could make the trade-offs between different service capabilities and how they would be integrated to good effect against the adversary, did you see a rather dramatic leap in performance. Now, that same kind of integrated approach is not what prevails in the Pentagon when it comes to making decisions about the way we're going to equip our forces and how we're going to build the force of the future. There, the bureaucratic norm is to keep most of that decision-making in service channels. There are some joint programs, but the as I pointed out, the MRAP wasn't one of them until the Secretary demanded that it be brought to the fore as the Pentagon's number one program. So the real question for us is who below the level of the Secretary of Defense or the chairman actually integrates all the different service perspectives in support of a program for him. And sadly, no one is really doing that for the chairman or the Secretary of Defense as things currently stand.
Wasn't that supposed to be at least part of the role of the Joint Requirements Oversight Council, or am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right about that. But most people look at the so-called JROC, Joint Requirements Oversight Council, and say that in practice it does not tend to make sharp distinctions between programs and elevating those that are a top priority and making trade-offs between them. It's more a case of validating everyone's requirement when that serves the interests of the organizations involved. So there's been a lot of disappointment about the ability of the JROC, the Joint Requirements Oversight Council, to make those kind of informed decisions. And I think it's because they don't have the analytic basis for making those decisions. They only have their various service perspectives of the senior leaders who sit on that council.